Be afraid. Be very afraid.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast and our 2-year anniversary.
Woohoo!
Yeah, 2 years already, guys.
It's
Sam Stepanenko.
Yes, it's gone faster than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And our slightly stuffy Trish Coughlin.
Yeah, yeah.
You brought a cold back from
Ireland.
Brought
back an Irish cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It makes you feel stuffy and a little drunk. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine every time you cough, it's like creme de menthe or something.
No, more Bailey's-ish.
Bailey's? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've been trying to drink enough whiskey to drown it, but it seems to just be so hungry for more. I can't
Well, that's because it's an Irish cold.
Yeah,
you don't feed it.
You can't treat an Irish cold with whiskey. It has to be like tequila or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got to kill an Irish cold with the tequila.
You got to go south. You got to go south.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A hot climate drink for a cold climate cold.
Yes.
That's okay, right.
I got it now.
My mom's cure-all is brandy for everything.
Oh, that was the thing. When I remember I was little, my mom would tell me, like, when babies would have teething problems, you gave them brandy on a little soaked rag.
Well, it would,
a lot of drunk babies in the olden days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would numb things, right? I think that's probably why. And, of course, they're getting a little bit drunk, so they feel less pain, because it's what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you do that face plant, you go, oh, that was so much fun. You wake up the next morning going, what the hell just happened?
Exactly. Yeah, no, too much drinking can give you that emotional pain. I'm just so sad. Why?
I was helping them out yesterday and moving like some really heavy objects.
Mm.
And she'd like take a break and she's like, I'll take a shot of this. And I'm like, I'm not drinking alcohol and lifting a 400-pound thing. I'm like, I'll see afterwards. Sure.
But see, the alcohol is going to make you think you can lift the 400-pound thing.
Oh, no. My delusions of grandeur can do that all by themselves.
And he'd be hurting a lot more than he is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. just having the next podcast, Jason's interaction. We're just trying to figure out the board.
And I'm like trying to point to the right thing with my tongue.
No, Jason, blink once for yes and twice for no.
Oh, real life.
But, you know. We're podcasters, so fuck real life.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about The Fly today.
All right.
Probably our second most requested movie remake that has ever been requested. Why didn't we do the first? Because we're saving it.
Yeah. We want special ones.
That's right. If you help us grow this audience, we will drop that one.
You betcha.
I think everybody knows what it is at this point, but we're going to save it.
Yeah.
Even if it's our very last episode.
Yeah, maybe be worried if we do it.
We're definitely going to do it.
Yeah.
Even if it is the last episode, where it's like, well, we can't go anymore. Here it is.
Yeah.
That's right.
Now we're episode.
It's like Death Race. What do we got to look forward to?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, no, we got a ton to look forward to, and that's a great thing. It's been two years, and I think we've barely scratched the surface of
movies and remakes. We may have to do it, because this might be one of those ones where they're going to remake it again, and we have to do it before then.
Well, there's a few where we're like, oh, maybe we should beat them to it.
Yeah, because they remade it once, and we're like, we can't watch 3 or 4 movies
again. Well, we can. We just need to plan ahead.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, we do.
It's a lot of movies.
Yeah, I still can't believe you guys did 4 for your very first episode.
Because we didn't know.
How could you not know that you'd have to watch 8 hours worth of film and then compare 8 hours worth of film?
We did more than that with King Kong.
Yeah, exactly.
And most of that was Peter Jackson.
That's a good point, yes.
The other two combined. I don't know. It was a theory. Like, it was theoretical 8 hours.
It was ambitious. It was an ambitious start to the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't know what we were doing.
No. No, no. But we know now.
Yes.
We're smarter. Yes,
and I'm certainly happy that a lot of people listened to that first episode. But I don't know, after listening to that one, why would you want to listen to another one? We've grown so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've grown and changed.
So, yeah, this week we're going to be talking about The Fly from 1958. Oh, good God, I forgot to write down the director. Man, what the hell? You can look it up.
Yeah.
First time, wow, 2 years and I finally fucked up on my notes.
No, 2 years and we're just not babysitting people anymore. You can look up the director.
That's right. Based on the story by George Langland, I guess. Sure, maybe. Pronounce it how you will.
Langolin.
And screenplay by James Clavell, who wrote The Great Escape. This movie had a budget of only $700,000, but it was 1958.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And grossed $3 million.
That's pretty good.
And I'm guessing that was a domestic take, because global takes are
over four times its budget. For a long time. So.
Yeah, no, it was a big, big success and spawned two sequels.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if I've seen them all. I know I've seen the second one.
I can honestly say I haven't, because I had never actually seen the original Fly.
Oh.
We've already talked about how much I'm not a big fan of the classic 50s and early 60s films, right? Mm-hmm. Which is funny, because I love like old Laurel and Hardy films. But yeah, just the stuff from this era, and it just never appealed to me. And this movie is actually a good example of why they don't. I did not really enjoy the original Fly.
Okay.
I found the acting to be very overdramatic, which was... typical of the time, especially for the horror films.
Yeah, it's very stage.
It's very stage. And like most films of the late 50s, early 60s, lot of dialogue, a lot of setup. I will admit, the first 30 minutes bored me to tears.
Yeah, I got to say, I wasn't super engaged in the rewatch of this, and it had been many, many years, and I'm like, this is not holding up.
Yeah, I love the middle.
There's some really smart stuff in it.
There is.
I didn't mind it at all. Yeah. I like the look of these films as well.
Oh, I love the look. The look was great.
The visuals of it, I enjoyed more.
Yeah. No, visuals, I really did enjoy, but yeah, just this was sort of the archetype of the film that drove me away from this era of film, mm-hmm. is the really stiff stage type acting and the very, very long setups.
Yeah, I kind of dug the building of this murder mystery.
Yeah, like it started off something different.
Interesting take on the monster genre that was prevalent in mm-hmm. the 50s. I mean, this was pretty late 50s, so there'd been a ton of them by that point.
Yeah, and they were clearly trying to do something a little bit different, and I mean, it worked. It totally worked, and it was interesting in the concept, but I found the execution dated. Mm-hmm. I guess the problem is it was dated.
Yeah, and I mean, it's always going to be dated, but it's sort of, if you can put that aside and like immerse yourself for like a moment, it's pretty good. It's enjoyable.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's still decent, I guess.
Yeah, but, yeah, and we were talking about Vincent Price before we started, and like, I love a Vincent Price movie. I will watch it all the time. Love it.
Yeah, we like Vincent. Vincent's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's just got that iconic voice. This is a very different role for him, though. Like, he wasn't the villain or anything else. He was the brother of the guy who becomes the Fly.
Well, he's more of a side character and sort of the audience proxy.
Yeah.
Is what he is in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this movie actually stars David Hedison is the title character, Andre Delambre, and... Delambre? Sure, yeah. I never could quite catch it.
I know, they said it. And then Helene.
Yeah. Patricia Owens as Helene. And Vincent Price as Francois. This all takes place in Montreal, actually, which is kind of cool.
Okay, yes.
Herbert Marshall was Inspector Charas. And Kathleen Freeman was Emma. I pretty much have the entire cast here. Betty Lou Gerson was the nurse. And Charles Herbert was Philippe, which was the little boy.
Nice. And Kathleen Freeman, that took me a while, but when you heard her talk, you're like, I've seen that woman in so many movies.
Mm.
She's always that sort of gruff housekeeper-esque character is usually what she is.
Yeah.
And I mean, both these movies have incredibly small casts.
Yeah, really. They're really tight, and they're pretty short movies for the most part.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both running around that hour and a half mark, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I was a little worried with the Netflix, because they listed, when I was watching the Jeff Goldblum remake, it said like 77 minutes. I'm like, that's like 20 minutes missing. But when I went in, I'm like, oh, no, the runtime's fine. So
yeah.
So they just had it mislisted. But I'm like, I don't want a TV hacked up.
No.
Version, and so I was gonna,
without the grossness,
gonna get really mad at Netflix, and but it's fine.
That's fine. That's good.
It was good. I even got Gina Davis side boobs, so I was happy.
Nice. They kept in all the grossness.
That was a big deal for me as a kid.
I don't know. They got shirtless Jeff Goldblum for me, so we're all set.
There you go. Boy, was he in shape.
He was in good shape.
He was a monstrous shape. Yeah.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah, well, yeah, pardon the pun. But, and that's, it's mainly because of Jeff Goldblum that those baboons were behaving, because there's no such thing as a tame baboon, so.
I know, yeah, the baboons. Every time I saw that, I'm like, it's a baboon.
The baboon just viewed Jeff Goldblum, this towering guy who had just gotten in great physical shape for this part, as the dominant alpha male in the room. So it's between him and the Wrangler, they kept the baboons in line, which, you know, could have gone messily for some of the female cast if those
super
things were
dangerous.
Wild. Yeah, they're very dangerous.
Well, and yeah, they kept the female cast. You'll notice there wasn't a lot of, there were no females anytime the baboons were on the screen.
That's right.
Except for the one bit where it's in the pod.
Pod, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But other than that, that's the only.
Oh, it got freaked out with the lights at one point, I guess. One of the outtake ones, it freaked out and crashed through the door. And yeah.
Well, yeah, I was surprised that they used baboons, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
Me too. That was always something that was weird. I thought, why baboons?
Yeah.
But it worked in that scene where Jeff is, or Brundle is sort of dialoguing with the baboon. I love that scene. It's actually probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because the baboon's paying such intent attention to him.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's like he's listening to every word that Brundle says.
Well, when it's not swiping at the fly, I like that.
I like that as well. Like there's it's just such a nice, tight little scene that works really well for me. So that maybe that's why they wanted something like that in there, and the baboons just seemed to be
there. Was one other baboon scene that was edited out, and that was when he's in that Brundle fly stage, and he's experimenting with the cross genetics with the machine, and so he threw a cat and a baboon in there, and they came out as a baboon cat. Kaboon.
Kaboon.
A kaboon.
Ooh, a kaboon. I would love a kaboon.
A kaboon. No, you wouldn't. It was cut, and then he beats it to death. Which, it's hard to feel sympathy for him at that point. And I get why they cut it, because, your sympathy's out the window, whether it's a real animal or a baboon cat. Yeah. Once you beat an animal to death, the sympathy just goes out the window.
It does. It completely changes the dynamic of the film.
Yeah, and then there's some wall crawling stuff after that, and an actual insect appendage comes out that he rips out of his abdomen. That's all been cut. It was pretty gross. It was awesome.
Yeah, the baboons are interesting, but I just, chimpanzees seem to me what people would have as a go-to.
Yeah,
like a human. Chimps are the closest to us, which I found.
Where does some guy running experiments in his basement get a baboon in the first place? Yeah.
That's my other question. You don't just order a baboon.
Yeah, it's like baboon from Amazon. Like,
is it the primate crate
for medical use?
Well,
only.
He's a respected scientist, so I'm sure that he has
primate
access
crate. Which
to.
Which one is it this month? It's the baboon.
Yeah. I mean, he was a respected scientist. I mean, it's not like he was like a basement scientist.
They open up at a big science conference.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and they mentioned that he was like, he'd almost won a Nobel Prize at the age of 20. So got access to scientific testing facilities such as animal testing, which nowadays doesn't play for obvious reasons.
Well, I mean, we're talking 1986 that this movie was made, so lots changed in the world of science since then.
Yeah, even in 1986, the whole concept of animal testing was becoming kind of a hot button, hot button topic for people is the treatment of animals, right?
Well, which is a different, if you look at the two different films, in the 1958 one, they do make very much of a point in how both Andre and Helene, they are not on board with, like, Andre just kind of out of character
uses the cat.
But before that, they're very much, he says, be careful with the cat. They're very much into keeping animals safe. They're not onto that. There was a different dynamic than this other film.
Yeah, you think if you're moving on to animal testing, you'd start a lot smaller than a baboon or a cat. Yeah, rats.
Rats are the go-to for all testing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. But I think you hit the nail on the head, as they were looking for a primate for Cronenberg's remake because it was closer to human DNA. But you're right, why wouldn't they use a chimpanzee instead of baboons?
Yeah, I have it on good authority. Clint Eastwood's got an extra rat in his pocket.
There you go. So why not use
throwback
that?
To last week.
Woohoo. Just use that. See, that would be dangerous. Just put Clint Eastwood in the thing. Oh, wait, I forgot that this... Oh, no.
Where is it?
I need some cheese. Lots of cheese. I'm just going to wander around.
Twitching.
A little twitching. He just starts wandering around hallways, just trying to find a way out. I don't know why. I just feel compelled to.
I'd pay good money to see Clint Eastwood do that.
I think a lot of people would.
Yeah. He's getting older. It might just happen and be sad.
Oh.
Sorry.
Ooh.
Okay, on to animal testing. Anyway.
Yeah, happier topic of animal testing.
But yeah, the baboons, because I don't know, baboons always terrified me. That's why some of those scenes were really scary. I'm like, oh, he's real close to a baboon.
Yeah, they were so expressive. I think that, and
their teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cronenberg never does anything without a reason. I'd like to know what his reason for using baboons was, because...
I think it was up to the terror. He likes to do that, I guess.
Yeah. The remake from 1986 was based on an adapted screenplay by Charles Edward Pogue, who wrote Dragonheart, DOA, and Psycho 3. And then Cronenberg came in later, rewrote the script. That was part of his whole thing, was coming in. I'm like, well, I want to rewrite the script. And those two never met at all. And... apparently, when they finally did and they shook each other's hands, apparently we made a successful movie together.
Nice.
Well, and Cronenberg insisted on credit for Pogue because he did come up with the core story, right?
And so. Cronenberg initially wasn't going to do this movie because he was tied up with Total Recall, which obviously never happened for him for various creative differences. So it freed him up to do this, and it's nice to know he had a hit movie anyway.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he knows how to do the horror of something going, like, body horror is his milieu.
Oh, yeah.
He knows
that's what to do. Very much the tone of this movie is so different from the other one. And yeah, he goes to the body horror stuff. And I'm a huge Cronenberg fan, but dude, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I think it's sort of
this is one of his more laid back ones.
It's interesting. He's one of his more laid back, but I think it's sort of, I don't know what there's anything wrong with him, is that he just understands that if you're going to go body horror, it's like just being completely out of control of your body is so terrifying. He knows how to ratchet that up in a certain way.
Yeah, it really is this channeling this fear of disease, I think, more than anything else, and how it can ravage a body. I mean, back then they used it as an allegory. A lot of the press used it as an allegory for AIDS, but it was just a much more broad intent in his mind, I think, was just disease in general. I mean, cancer and everything else, and that, how it ravages a body.
Yeah, and I think the only disease that he actually mentions, in the dialogue is cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, that was the press that kind of changed it to an HIV thing, but that was just a big subject in the 80s. So
it was, especially right around then, because that's when it was. It was no longer, pardon me, but the gay disease, right? Yeah. It was starting to affect the heterosexual population as well.
Yeah, which is apparently the only time people cared.
Yeah, and well, I mean, if you guys don't know David Cronenberg, Jesus,
why are you listening to us?
Yeah, but I mean, this goes on and on and on. Eastern Promises, Dead Zone, Scanners, Existenz, History of Violence, Naked Lunch, Shivers, goes
Crash.
On. Crash.
Crash.
Yeah. You want to talk about body horror in a completely different approach to it.
Or Naked Lunch. Yeah. Also very...
Oh, yeah, I mentioned that.
Yeah.
And that's what I kept thinking of when I was watching this movie, is that one. And Existenz.
Especially the more dream sequence when she's dreaming of giving birth to a larvae.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah. Cameo by David Cronenberg in there.
Yes.
He's great in cameos. I love him when he does them.
Or in bigger roles.
Yeah. So the movie starred Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, John Getz, Jay Bouchel. She was Tawny.
Nice.
We'll get to that. Leslie Carlson and George Chuvalo.
And David Cronenberg.
And David Cronenberg in tiny part behind a mask.
Yeah.
He was the,
but you know it's him.
Yeah, he was the one delivering the larvae. Of course he would.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a good time to run the trailer for the original Fly, and I have some comments about that on the other side.
Will everyone in the theater hold on firmly to his seat, please? I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
Andre, please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector, Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
The fly is on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
Okay. Thanks, Vincent Price, for not showing us the movie. Now, that was an auditory experience, even for me, who actually was watching the trailer, because Vincent Price comes out of that scream, and there's just this, you can hear the buzzing of the fly, and it's this red line squiggling across the screen while you're hearing all those voice clips in the trailer. I'm like, yeah, screw you. Yeah. You don't show me any.
Suspenseful.
Does that not show confidence in your movie, or maybe too much confidence in your movie?
I don't know.
It could go either way. You're right.
Yeah.
Because it could quite easily just be like, we don't want to give away too much, so we think you're going to enjoy it, so we're going to just do this to you. Mm. Or alternatively, it's like, this movie is so bad that we can't bring ourselves to show you anything. But in this case, I think it was that they wanted the reveal to.
Yeah, by 1958, Vincent Price was a huge star.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, that voice is what was selling that trailer anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
What'd you think of the opening credits of this one? I didn't mind them. It just goes into like a close-up. I was wondering what the hell was happening, and all of a sudden a fly comes out of this little hole on the screen.
Yeah. No, I was fine with it. It was...
It's different.
It never really made an impact on me, to be honest, but...
I just liked
it. They were getting a little more creative in the 50s. I mean, we were getting really close to the 60s by then, so...
Yeah, and title sequences seem to be getting more engaging.
Yeah. You mentioned something about the synth music during that trailer.
Yes, I did. I mean, that's clearly not the original music for the trailer.
Yeah, I was wondering about that myself.
Yeah, because synthesizers were available in the late 50s, but they were the old Hammond organ synthesizers. They had a very different sound than that. That's a very 80s Yamaha Korg kind of sound.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a kind of a remix of the classic trailer that was maybe re-released when the 80s one came out.
And I think Trish made that point as well. And it would make sense that they would do it, right?
Yeah.
Or you just got a real big fan and wanted to update it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I did compare it to a couple other trailers, and it matched up, so it could, I'm guessing it was probably a video release.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, version. on the heels of the remake, they'd want to remonetize it in some way, of course.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Of course. It wouldn't be foolish not to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Although, you know, when I watch Vincent Price movie in color, I'm always a little weirded out.
I was too.
I don't know why.
He shouldn't be in color.
Yeah. Well, it's just in my mind, that's where majority of his era was still black and white.
Well, it's like seeing in color photos of Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy, like some of these guys that you're kind of classic black and white actors, and then you see them in color, and it just feels wrong. They think it's like they were born in black and white. They should stay in black and white.
How dare you exist in a color world?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you imagine, like, if time travel was a thing, and you went back to like the 30s, and you're like, oh, so that's what everything actually looked like.
Yeah. It was funny to go back to last week's episode, actually. So it just reminded me of something. Did you know that 3D actually works better in black and white than it does in color?
I would imagine.
I can see
so,
why.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I was reading that because we were talking about the 3D creature from the Black Lagoon. And I meant to mention in last week's episode that, yeah, they found that was one of the reasons it kind of faded away, was because it didn't work as well in color as it did in black and white.
Yeah, I can see that.
Well, it's because you're using those two kind of filters
with
the glasses.
Yeah.
And yeah. Then you've lost that spectrum.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've got that, yeah, red and green or red and blue,
yeah,
alternatively. And, yeah, if you start taking away the color and just go shades of gray, you don't have to worry about that conflict of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it worked really well.
Yeah, and to be honest, lighting was so much easier in black and white.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the reasons why Clerks went the way they did with the mm-hmm. black and white.
Yeah.
It's so much easier. You don't have to worry, and it can just increase your shoot time to far more efficiency.
Yeah, minimal lighting.
Yeah.
Lighting requirements.
Well, yeah.
So if we were color balancing and all that
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, f-stops and that sort of thing. It's not nearly as a precise a process, so you can just light it by eye and it'll look fine.
Yeah, interesting technical side note.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. And which is why we don't do a lot of film cameras anymore. So lighting is, again, gone back to, does it look good on the monitor? Yep. All right.
There you go.
Because it's all digital now. Yep. And digital, you don't have to worry about f-stops and stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ah, yeah. So much different. So
yeah. It's not the art form it used to be, but it certainly is a lot easier.
Makes the process easier for sure.
Yeah. But what's fun is sometimes when they go back, like, what was I just telling you, that show Inside Number 9, they did like an old episode that was based on like those old kind of late 70s, early 80s, and they used like the same old cameras, so they had to light it all the same way. They had to get these old guys to come back and actually use the cameras because nobody else knew how to.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, if you want to capture that feel, sometimes you have to use the old technology, but a lot of people try to use filters. It doesn't do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. No. Now, the original 58 starts with the ending. Which is something sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. This one I did, because it kind of makes it a murder mystery as we go through it. And it's Helene is caught at the Delombre. That factory. And it's a machining electronics factory. And she's caught near this big press.
Mm-hmm.
This tin press, and this is all from the point of view of the night's watchman's guy, and mm-hmm. sees her run off and this body hanging out of it, and she's not talking, at least not for a while.
Yeah.
No, she runs home first.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the security for just a second, because that is going to be one of the most amazingly bad, hammy, stunned, startled, scared close-ups I've ever seen. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I complain about the overacting, but this is one moment where I got this big shit-eating grin on my face when I saw him do that.
It was good.
There's
was
a good. Lot of insanity, because Vincent Price gets the call from her.
Yeah.
And she's basically saying, I killed my husband. Yeah, it's what you do.
Yeah.
And so he calls the Inspector Shiras, who's not at a police station. He's hanging out in some country club.
Well, it's almost midnight when she calls him.
Okay, still.
And it's like, I get the feeling that he called him because he knew him. He wasn't calling the police. Yeah. He was calling a policeman
and
he knew.
And she's not arrested. And Shrust doesn't even think about arresting her for what seems like weeks of movie time.
Yes.
She gets to sit at home with a freaking nurse under psychological evaluation, essentially.
It was at least 2 weeks, because I remember she actually says, I've been in this bed for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And there's also this this undercurrent of questions, how long do flies live? Because that's also a very important part of what's happening.
No, she's always distracted if she hears a buzz and she's looking at the fly, and then she looks very disappointed if it's just a fly.
For understandable reasons.
Very good reason.
But at this point,
she's not revealing why that point.
But when you understand the why, her reactions at the beginning of the film make less sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason she needed to catch that fly is now gone.
Yeah.
Right? So kind. Yeah. Her reactions
sort
were.
Of.
Well, no, because
but it also it,
she
it,
does by this point she wants to catch the fly to kill it.
Yeah, she.
It's a mercy.
She needs to get rid of it because the fly is the final bit of evidence that she needs to get rid of, so that as per Andre, nobody will ever find out what happened.
Yeah. Well, there's a scene where the nurse or the or her housekeeper is chasing down that fly, and she's going, "Don't kill it! Don't kill it! Don't kill it!"
I think she wants to see it.
And I think that might be it. But you can see the remains after they've been squashed. She could have checked that way. So I mean,
think she's always struggling.
It's a minor.
Yeah,
nitpicky thingy that I'm doing here, obviously, but it's just it.
Yeah, no, she does seem to flip flop a lot.
Yeah.
Far as kill it, not kill it, kill it, not kill
well,
it.
Well, I think it's sort of,
or maybe she just wants that responsibility.
She needs
to herself
that final bit. Like, I think if she can see it, and like as they see what it looks like, because I mean, she knows what has been replaced on her husband. She figures that's what she'll see on the fly.
Yeah, we don't even actually see her husband until, oh, Jesus, like 30 minutes into the film, almost, by the time, and he's the title character and lead actor in this film, despite the fact we only see the human version of him for maybe 5 minutes of screen time.
Well, I think they were establishing the whole thing is where she's basically on her own a lot because he's always in his lab.
Yeah.
They're happily married, but
she seems to be very comfortable with the dynamic. Like, well, that's the way he is.
They have their separate lives. They love each other. When they spend time together, they're very happy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a very happy home.
Yes, it is a very happy home.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why the dynamic works is because he is gone for such... like sort of disappears into his lab for such extended periods of time that she gets a chance to miss him. Right.
And he might miss her. Like that's sort of sometimes when he comes up.
Yeah. And he shares the experiment when he's kind of figured it out and grabs that plate and transports it, shows her how it works. And they kind of just look like fish tanks and that, you know, you get a lot of light and
I love the light show though. I thought that was so bright and colorful.
Yeah, it was good. And then she's like, wow, that's amazing. And flips it over and the Maiden Shine is all backwards.
Yeah. It's mirrored and mirror images it. Yeah. Which is where he's like, oh no, that's not right. Because you can't mirror image.
Yeah, and that's the thing. When he has some sort of realization, he's just gone now. There's no talking to him at that point. He's now in thinking mode.
Yeah, she understands that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some of that in the remake as well. Not the same sort of completely disconnected type of focus, but Seth Brundle has that same sort of mentality. There's the great scene in the remake where she unintentionally gives him a clue as to how to solve his problem. And then that's it. Boom.
I'm wondering with the Brundle's wardrobe where he has just five of the same outfit.
Mm-hmm. Which was wonderful.
And
I love that.
Yeah, he credits that to Einstein and he just doesn't have to think about it. But I'm wondering if that was a bit of an homage to the original film as well, because we only see the title character, Andre, in one outfit except for the time when they go to the ballet.
Yeah, but they, I mean,
otherwise he's in the same outfit through the whole movie.
Is he still
including as a fly?
Is he still in the outfit in the backyard, or is it just an outfit in the backyard with a lab?
No, he's always got the same outfit except for when he goes to the ballet.
Yeah, and it may have been right.
Yeah.
Which, when we're thinking about this, bringing the differences that I noticed in the dynamic is in the original, they are a married couple. They've been married for a number of years because their son. How old is he? Like 8. 9, 10
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So they've been married quite a while. So that's a different dynamic. So you can see, like, she's in it for the long haul. They're both in it for the long haul. In the remake, it's sort of, they just sort of met and are starting a relationship.
Oh, man.
So can you see how hard it would be to start a relationship with somebody who's going through something really weird? Like, it seems it would be hard for me to, like, get that connection and that I'm not going to leave them type of feeling.
Well,
you're just starting out.
Yeah, well, with Gina Davis, I think it all started out as research trying to get that article.
But
probably that mentality initially was just to kind of get on so she can stick around. Although I don't think she ever intended to sleep with him to get that far.
No.
She developed feelings for him because she spent so much time with him, right?
Yeah, and that movie
speeds. But it's still a new relationship.
Yeah, that movie does speed along. Like the time passing is a bit suspect at times. You're not sure. There are times when, as he's progressing through his Brundlefly stages, where we know they haven't seen each other in about 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But in those early moments of the film, the the time passage is weird and awkward, and I'm not sure exactly how much time is passing. If it could be days, it could be weeks.
It seems like a super fast relationship to me, is what it seemed like.
It does. It does, yes. And I mean, I remember when I was watching it for the podcast, because it's been a long time since I saw it last, and that did sort of stick with me. It's like, wow, they really kind of move from getting to know each other to knowing each other fairly quickly.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen it in a while as well, and I was kind of like, I don't remember them getting together that quickly, but...
Mm-hmm. It's real quick.
It is real quick. I always thought this movie was longer and with a bit of a slower pace, but it's pretty unrelenting.
Oh yeah, no, the pace of it is actually pretty breakneck when you get into it.
I thought
it would be like you said, because Cronenberg likes to take his time with really getting you uncomfortable.
Yeah,
he did not with this one.
Oh, these movies are of a very similar runtime. He keeps them; they're very close as far as how long it takes to watch them. They're just a little over 3 hours combined.
Yeah, no, she has a more close, it seemed to be, it's weird, she has a more deep ingrained relationship with her stalker than she does with Seth Brundle. <Yeah.
laughs> Yes, her stalker boss, ex-professor.
Well,
Ex-boyfriend.
Yeah, so there's like a whole shitload of creepy there.
Yeah.
It is, and I do kind of like the dynamic. I mean, it's a good thing that Jeff Goldblum recommended Gina Davis, because they were dating at the time. There's great chemistry there. It really works on screen.
Yeah.
But the opposite is true as well. There's like no chemistry with Stathis.
Yeah.
Because she just fucking hates him.
Yeah.
It's the ex-boyfriend that won't go away.
Yeah, but then in times of trouble, she goes to him?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He still
signs the checks.
If I have a psycho stalker, whether I work for him or not, he's not the guy I'm going to when shit goes downhill.
And FYI, if your ex asks for the key back, you give the key back.
Yeah, no, you don't do that. Or you change the locks immediately.
Right?
Yeah.
You find your ex-boyfriend showering in your place, or vice versa. I mean, this goes the other way, too. Yeah. You kick their asses out and call a locksmith.
The only alternative would be is like if it was a good relationship, but you broke up and still friends, and you come home and you're like, hey, what are you doing here? Like, that's a different dynamic, but she hates him.
Yeah.
You don't do that.
They seem to be on a better relationship when it's business, when they're just talking about business. And it's really weird that she gets upset that he's in her apartment, but they don't have really much animosity when they're in the office.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is like she talks about the Psychology Today gig. I'm like, take it, then find out why he's so fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Because that's a dynamic that makes very little sense, even in context of the movie.
Yeah. I guess the original script had her ending up with Stathis.
Mm.
And
that's troubling.
Yeah. Well, and that was the problem. It didn't test well.
Nobody
liked him, and everybody was pretty upset that she would wind up with him afterwards.
Well, Dan Getz is the actor, right?
Yeah.
This was his bread and butter, playing somebody you fucking hate.
John Getz.
I remember him in so many movies playing a person you fucking hate.
The thing is, you don't even hate him. You just find him kind of slimy.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and...
I hated him.
Yeah. I mean, even his heroic sacrifice at the end, you just didn't feel bad for him.
No. Not really.
No.
It's his damn hand and his...
I had a little bit of respect because the guy was, like, going through shock.
Hand and it just got melted.
And his foot
melted right off. Yeah.
Yeah.
See,
so
but that was...
Through all that shock, he still manages to do something.
Funny enough is that it's... You know when they have a save the cat moment that's early in the film? This is the save the cat moment at the climax. So it's really hard to make that turn to like
him. Yeah, no, there's not enough to make you like him, but it's really the only one good thing we see him do in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite redeem him.
No. It's their dynamic boggled my mind.
Yeah,
it was
really antagonistic.
And the funny thing is, I remember playing, like I remember seeing this in the theaters in the 80s, and even thinking then, like, that just doesn't make sense. I love the rest of the movie, but that relationship just didn't make sense. And I mean, you were supposed to, I don't think you were supposed to dislike him, though, as much as you did. This is one of those few cases where Cronenberg kind of missed it.
Actually, considering it is Cronenberg, and there's only one thing that doesn't make sense... That's a pretty good track record.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cronenberg thinks about these things.
If there's only one, that's probably the most straightforward Cronenberg movie you're ever going to see.
You know what? If you could probably change that entire dynamic in the film with the elimination of two scenes, eliminate the part where he shows up at her apartment and has a shower, just helps himself to the shower.
Yeah.
And the part in the clothing store where he's followed her. If you eliminate those two scenes, the rest of the scenes would make more sense why she'd come to him. Yeah. Even though it's antagonistic. If you eliminated those two creepy, stalkery bullshit, he could be a character you could be on board with.
Yeah.
I feel that those were the mistakes.
Yeah, and maybe even eliminate the past relationship, the past, whole past boyfriend. Oh, no, that's important, though, really later on, because that's his motivation for going through the pods.
But so. if you think about it, like, if you can have the past relationship, but just have them both understand it's the past.
Yeah, it would have worked better. You're right. I think that what happened there was definitely not deliberate by Cronenberg. I think that he just kind of didn't quite see what was going to happen with that character.
I wonder if he didn't want to maybe keep her. It was weird. If he'd not made that guy the person she goes to, it would have really fed into an idea where she's isolated in this situation.
Yeah.
She has a man who's changing completely and a man she can't trust, and that would put her in more peril with this thing that's growing in her as well. That's a whole new part.
Well, considering how little time they had when going into this production, it was like 3-month turnaround to get this thing going, and that was especially with the special effects guys on that remake. So, kudos to Chris Wallace, who won an Oscar for all that special effects makeup
and
doing it in the short amount of time that he had. His studio had a choice of doing Gremlins 2, The New Batch, or The Fly.
With Christopher Lee, by the way.
And they'd already done Gremlins, so they're like, well, you know, it's going to be harder, but we like the challenge. And I respect that.
Yeah, and it's Cronenberg.
Absolutely.
And it's Cronenberg. That alone, it would be very attractive. Yeah. Although, you know, it was Cronenberg. I don't know if he'd had any huge movies at that point. I mean, a lot of respect. But
And that's what I mean is because I don't think he had, like, I mean, because Scanners, Videodrome, it was probably his most successful up to this.
Yeah.
And I was actually wondering if the guys who did the makeup on this also worked with him on Videodrome, because there are some similarities later in the movie. The whole, I mean, this is probably
Cronenberg tends to go back to the same guys a lot, cinematographers and whatnot. In fact, I think The Fly, this was the first movie he'd changed cinematographers because the other guy wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't used anybody since. He's stuck with that same guy through every project. I just wanted to mention $15 million budget, 1986, gross $37.5 million. So not bad, pretty decent success. It did spawn a sequel that didn't fare so well. And I do remember it doesn't watch so well, and I don't think Cronenberg had anything to do with it.
I remember Eric Stoltz in it and a lab, and that's all I got.
Yeah, Eric Stoltz was playing
the son.
The offspring of the
Was it Martin Brundle, I think?
I don't remember his name.
I don't remember. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah. Cronenberg did write a sort of sequel, apparently, but it was not a direct sequel. It was kind of like a side sequel. It was somebody working on the same the remnants of the technology, and sort of running into a similar problem, but not direct. None of the original characters were even in it.
Apparently, Gina Davis tried to get a somewhat of a sequel that tied into this version with her later husband, Rennie Harlan, which obviously never happened. But
no,
thank goodness, because Rennie Harlan, not good. I'm sorry. He's had a few okay movies, but mostly no.
He can have, there's some fun, you're right, but there's some fun stupid ones. I'll give him some
he's
fun
gone
stupid.
To turds to Guilty Pleasure.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. I like his Guilty Pleasure, but I need more than that.
His Nightmare on Elm Street was pretty fun.
Yes.
Yeah, I just need more than that from him, like for this Fly movie, because there is a lot of emotional stuff happening underneath it.
Mm-hmm. In both movies.
So you need it.
Yeah. So let's go back to the original one.
Yes.
Because we jump out of that really fast. Mm-hmm. She's in bed for like most of the movie until Vincent Price, he gets a little story from Philippe about this white-headed fly. So he's already seen her act a little weird about the flies in the house. And I think he grilled the housekeeper as well about that and learned about this white-headed fly. So he basically just straight up lies to her and says, oh yeah, I've got the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And then she thinks, oh, well, you already know then. And so that's when she starts recounting the story, and he says, no, I want Shiraz here.
And she says, I want Shiraz here because I don't want to say it more than
once. Oh, that's right. Yeah. She does. To recount the story, which, you know, by the end of Shiraz just thinks she's insane. But she recounts the whole story about going to the
narrator.
Lab. Yeah, she becomes the narrator of the story. And it's pretty... It's still a fairly slow-paced movie, but it is still interesting to see it from that perspective. and how traumatic it is for her to also keep these secrets. She doesn't know basically what's happened. No. He's not communicating except through notes under the door
because he can't.
And when he finally allows her into the lab, which is funny, why didn't she walk in? The Deadpool was on her side.
Yeah.
That drove me nuts where you could hear him unlocking it. I'm like, Deadpool's on your side, lady.
Oh, I thought they were on both sides. I could be wrong. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was the whole thing where they'd had this agreement that, like, you don't know what's going on. Like, I wasn't allowed in, like, when my dad was welding. That was a whole thing. It's a safety issue.
Yeah.
You can't just walk in to a lab. So.
Yeah, and it could be, in mid-experiment, and that could be
dangerous for everybody.
She had to have those goggles on. If she walks in and gets blinded.
Those goggles were awesome.
Yeah, they were.
I know, right? Yeah. Those are hardcore, and I'm like, I love it.
I want those bubble goggles. Those are great.
Those were really awesome, actually. And I remember going, those are kind of cool. Very modern.
Yeah.
I mean, the original movie is far more psychological than visual, unlike the remake.
We don't even see him experiment on himself.
No.
That's what I'm like, I've seen this movie before, but I'm like, I could have swore we saw that scene.
I don't know. I think it's...
That's how well they do that. It's
really good.
It's not important because we've already seen him run that experiment a few times. We see him run it with the cat who's meowing into nothingness.
Oh, that poor cat.
It was.
Yeah.
At least
then the guinea pig.
Then the guinea pig at least survives it, but... Although the nothingness was like, oh, at least it wasn't splattered on the inside like the other movie with the first pepper.
And well, and certainly a more sensitive time, so a more sensitive approach. I mean, the fact that they disintegrated the cat and sent it off into the ether was probably pretty traumatizing as it was.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. To not know.
Yeah. Right. Whereas in 1986, visual experiences were very, very big, right? We kind of gotten away from that. Get in your head and mess with you kind of horror science fiction. It was now let's shock the shit out of you kind of horror science fiction, both of which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I particularly enjoy it when it's both in the same movie, but
yeah, but alternatively,
and this fly actually did successfully pulled off both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, with the other fly where you can show it, we know for a fact that they didn't just dismember some sort of animal and put it in there.
Oh, yeah. No,
whereas
of course not.
In some, as we know, in some of the oldie timey movies, they weren't too fussed about messing with an animal.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's a good thing it was just a sound effect. Cat's fine.
Yeah.
Well, I'm assuming it's long dead by this point, but yeah,
cute.
It would have been fine.
But it was not harmed during the filming of this motion picture.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think, I don't know, I think it was probably limitations with showing it. So they decided to just make it a mental thing.
And we don't even see the larger pods until, after he's had his accident.
Yeah, because you don't even really know he's constructed them until.
Yeah. Right. And I do find it interesting, like, well, how's it working? Because, okay, you've got that fly head and fly arm, and he seems to be wrestling with it, yet the head and the human arm are on the little fly. He still seems to be somewhat in charge of his faculties as the, human fly.
See, and that was my weird, in both movies, my conundrum was how it seemed to be the fly part in both movies was the dominant force. Like, in the remake, that fly basically takes over Seth, like that baser instinct. And then in the original, he's fighting with that fly baser instinct in his human form. But as a fly, he can't control where the fly goes and he can't fly to somebody for help.
Mm-hmm.
He's not doing that.
No, it really feels like split personality. And I'm like, well, if you got the fly head, wouldn't your brain be in the little fly?
See, yeah. So
wouldn't that just be a really smart fly?
Which is addressed in the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode where Bart goes into the pod and his head is on the fly, but his head is controlling that fly and wherever it goes. And then Bart with the fly head is just all fly.
Bart, are you in there? Have you forgotten our little Kablamo talk?
Mom, stop! According to this, it says Bart mixed up his DNA with the flies. I think that's Bart.
I think she's right. The pants are a dead giveaway.
Which, and obviously the writers of that particular episode have the same issues with that as we do.
Yeah. Simpsons did it.
They figured it out. They're like, this was bugging us. Thank you, Simpsons. You got it for us.
Yeah. And there's that whole suspension of disbelief, but because, yeah, you're right. It seemed like Andre's intellect was transferred to both the human fly and then the fly human, but the fly human, he couldn't control that fly body. And in the human fly, anybody confused yet? Because I am. He just couldn't speak and didn't really have any control of that one limb, but he still seemed to have all of his faculties. He knew what he needed to do. He was able to figure out the solution. He just needed to execute it by getting that.
But then as you were going on, he was saying as he was typing, having trouble keeping control, straining. So it was overtaking him.
Yes.
In the weirdest way.
And and that's probably the greatest flaw in both movies. You're right. Is why would I don't want to say lesser creature, because they're not really lesser creatures, but certainly a less intelligent creature be able to take over that something, a more complex organism. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. A less complex organism.
At least they explain it somewhat in the remake. You know, it's a more of a fusion of their genes as the body is adjusting to this new genome and making the transformation.
Yeah, but like you say, it's still all those baser instincts are more powerful than what is the human aspect of him. Which I suppose is probably part of what Cronenberg was getting at, is there's this like this sadness to losing your humanity.
Yeah, in a way, like he does also makes a very base drug allegory about that as well. You know, he's running on a huge adrenaline rush, and he's just high on all these new powers and just buzzed.
Yeah, pardon the pun. No, don't pardon the pun. That was a good one.
That's good.
Just buzzed.
I like it.
Buzzed all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, part of it too, I think that there is some sort of commentary there is about how base human beings really are when you get down to it. I think there's part of that. That was part of the commentary as well, is that we consider ourselves to be superior to other creatures, including flies and other insects, when really we're not. Right, we still have our base instincts, and we just suppress them better than most.
Oh,
maybe.
Yeah, and you can have somebody like with Seth, like such a person who was all about his intellect. Like he says it in dialogue. I've been by myself the whole long. He's perfectly content to let his mind and everything else be his playground. And then when it comes to like human contact, he had nothing. But once that's opened up, it really goes out of control.
Yes, it really does. So I think there was that sort of reaction to being in touch with your baser instincts, and not necessarily in a good way either.
Mm-mm. Right.
Oh, Tawny.
So he breaks the arm of your boyfriend, and you still go with him.
And at this point, too, she did not agree in the bet. He's like, I get to take her home. I'm sorry if you've said I'm not part of this fucking bet. And I've also said no. So you can bugger right off.
By the end of it, she didn't seem too upset after the marathon sex. So.
No, she didn't. But I'm just saying she's made some very questionable life choices, and maybe she needs to see a therapist.
You might be correct. But hey, she has no idea what she escaped. So.
Oh my God, yeah.
So she got very lucky because Gina Davis showed up at the right time with the scary line.
Yes.
Thank God you showed up.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go back to the other one. We're talking about like humanity and baser instincts. What I found was interesting is there's a line that Andre talks to his wife about when he's like, think about this whole thing. There's no more famine, no more this. We can get transferred here, there. And I'm like going, oh, sweetie, you think humans are great. Aw, how precious. Like that scientist altruistic feeling. I'm like going, ooh, yeah, the baser instincts of humanity are not going to help you in your invention, sir.
No.
This is going to be used in the worst way possible. It will probably be used to create famine. It will probably be used to control countries. It will probably be used to just pull some really dubious shit.
It will be used to deliver troops to remote areas and take over countries.
Well, you know,
deliver
what?
A bomb somewhere. Of course it will.
I'm going to run the trailer for the remake while I try to reinvigorate my co-hosts' faith in humanity somehow. And we'll be back and we'll talk some more about the fly.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have 3 other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is...
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pipe with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it. It could be contagious.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
That was The Fly from 1986, produced by comedy legend Mel Brooks.
Yep.
He was one of four producers, but that's the one worth mentioning.
Oh, when I first saw Brooks films, I'm like, what the, huh?
One of these things is not like the other.
I was amazed.
Yeah, I remember when I was kind of reading like the Wikipedia interview on this, I'm like, Mel Brooks? The Mel Brooks?
Yeah, he initially tried to keep his involvement secret because he didn't want his reputation hampering this film. Because the comedy legend, people might have thought that. And I get that because I have the same reaction every time Seth Rogen produces something that isn't a comedy.
Well, Mel Brooks is such a prevalent producer. He really was.
Yeah, he really was, and people don't realize that. But when it did wind up getting outed, and so at the film premiere, he was like handing out those little googly insect ears things that you put on your head.
The antennae?
Yeah, the bobbers.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wait, the ones with the glasses that bobble out?
Or no, the antennae ones.
Oh, okay. The antennae ones, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I love those ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Google it. Kids these days probably don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, we are much older than you. Just Google it. Look for image search.
But we're not so old we can't just say Google it.
Yeah, true. That's right.
True. Oh, sorry. Another line that came from the previous film that I thought was really interesting, where Andre is talking to Helene and she's like, I'm just scared of all this new technology. He's like, we just have to treat it like Philippe, like he does. This is just the world now. This is just how it is. And I'm like, thinking about that, that was 1958. And now I am the age I am now, where I'm like, well, there's Snapchat, there's all these Twitter, all these other things. That's just children's reality now. And it scares me, but I'm like, but that's their reality. It's so weird that carries forward so well.
Well, at the lead of the podcast, I mentioned I was moving a heavy object for my parents. It was a jukebox. And actually two of them, but I won't get into that. But I just pulled out my phone and I'm like, can't you switch?
Yeah, MP3s, they weigh nothing.
Well, my mom likes your 45s.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of cross-generational, I mean, we're all in that age group where we got to see all of this change. I still agree that there's still something to be said for the physical copy, especially when it comes to like records.
Yeah. Because
there is something to be said about it. And I think that's why picking on hipsters, but this one thing they've got right is going back to those old formats and hearing the things the way they were originally meant to be heard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So
They do sound better.
And I mean, your mom's preferred music genre is it's just sounds better on vinyl too. It sounds so much better on vinyl. Sure.
And look, you know, you think about the romantic aspect too. You can't like dance with earbuds. So her and dad get to, you know, dance in the basement or whatever.
Nice.
That's cute.
I don't even want to imagine what they're doing to it, but
you went from cute to wrong, Jay. Why? Yeah. Why'd you do that?
I just said I don't want to think about it.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
Jay spent too much time with me. That's the problem.
Yeah, no, because I was just having this really nice thought, because I know your parents, and I think I was having this, oh, that'd be so adorable. And then you just went the whole don't even want to think about it thing, and I'm like,
what? And then you're the one who went, oh, Jay. And I'm like, but I don't want to think about it.
Well, to get back to the movie and talking about flesh, anyway. Thank you.
Yes. that was a really good line in the movie, by
really
the way.
It's really good.
His flesh thing. I don't think there's a Cronenberg movie that doesn't have a line about flesh.
Yeah.
But how we're talking about how digital versus the analog vinyl is like how it was, it's trying to synthesize what it imagines something to be rather than what it actually is.
Yes.
That was an interesting computer because it seemed to do more thinking than Goldblum did. Goldberg. Goldblum.
Well, you use it, that's the thing. Like computers, you'll use it to run a lot of like simulations. You'll use it to do kind of some of the grunt work. You just have to program it. FYI, that keyboard is in the wrong way to be ergonomically viable. That bothered me so much. It was
really cool and retro for even for 86.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, there's a line that he says, that Brundle says, is he says, computers are dumb until you tell them what they need to know. And so, the computer seemed like it was doing more thinking, but it was filling in gaps that he'd left. And then he actually kind of explains that later on, is that he's unintentionally found another use for his pods because the computer didn't know what to do when there were two objects in there. So it just combined them back, put it all back together.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that it did more thinking. It just did what it was told.
And I kept thinking, like, if they came across, like, I always thought, like, the sequel of this was going to be if the military came across this technology and started making super soldiers out of men and some other object, like some other creature. That was what I kept thinking about. I'm like, oh, my God.
Well, yeah, in the end, it was that I thought that was interesting where the splicing of him in the pod was was his undoing.
Mm-hmm. And see, that was the resulting mutation was actually what made me wonder if it was the same group that did Videodrome, because there was that same sort of man-machine element happening there that looked very similar to Videodrome.
Yeah, there's a lot of that totally in Existenz as well, that fleshy machinery.
Oh, yeah, and that like that plug-in.
Yeah.
And I mean, visually, it's disturbing and cool at the same time. That's why I think I still love Videodrome, even though it's extremely dated now. And this movie and Existenz, they all have that sort of really interesting incorporation of man and technology, which Cronenberg was also very good at, or is also very good at commenting on.
What I think about is like fleshy technology, like living tissue combined with some sort of technology is what he was always going on about. Like Existenz is like, it's this thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This gooey thing.
He does like his goo.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. The fingernails.
Did you mention that he's Canadian, if you didn't know already?
Yes, he is a Canadian treasure.
We love him. But yeah, like there's a lot of the goo and the goopiness, and it's sort of, it's strange to watch like the deterioration of Jeff Goldblum in this movie, where it just, they did such a good job at having it transition to where it should go.
And it's so gradual too, like you just notice these little things changing at first. Right, like, you know, like the, just the little hairs on his back, and then you notice that his skin's kind of changing a little bit.
He's very sallow.
Yeah, well, the hairs were cleverly placed where the microchip scar was, where they were copulating on the bed, and he impaled himself on some experiment that he'd lost.
Yeah,
which was very funny, actually.
Yeah, the absent-minded professor thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's where that went.
But yeah, so Fresh Wound, and that's where all the hairs first start growing out of.
Yeah, where she gets them tested, and they're not human.
Yeah, you figured that would be set off the alarm bells a lot earlier instead of, you know, your nails getting pulled off.
Yeah, well, and your teeth falling out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Took him a while before he realized that something was actually wrong, and he thought, you know, like, oh, geez, is this how I die?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fairly logical assumption that when you, like, that he made, that, and extrapolation that he makes.
Yeah, well, he
like,
felt so good, and he wanted to share that, but he's also manic about it.
Yeah, he's like going through the thing, through the pot, it had purified him somehow, right? And he'd never felt so alive in his whole life, and as he's spooning, like, literally a container of sugar into his espresso.
You know, the use of sugar actually in both movies is pretty good. Yeah. Like You know, Helene's trying to lure the white-headed fly with the sugar on the table, and the fly version of Andre asks for a bowl of milk with rum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and especially in Cronenberg's, where it's just he's eating candy bars and ice cream, and just
donuts,
can't stop
donuts
and can't stop eating the sugar.
Yeah, until of course he has to vomit on it to eat it.
Well, he did develop some skin problems fairly early on.
Yes,
I'm like, oh, he's getting acne.
Yeah, too much sugar, man. Too
That's
much.
What
sugar.
Happens? Too much sugar.
But yeah, I don't know. It was weird. It's sort of the. He thinks it purified him, and when you think about it, like, that would be kind of the ultimate usage for this stuff, is like, oh, you got a tumor? We're just going to transport you from here to here and put the tumor as separate from you into a different pot. Like, wouldn't that be a great use of it? Or gain 20 pounds? 20 pounds of fat's going into the other pot. You're coming out svelte.
Yeah. When he asks the computer about maybe figuring out how to get him back to being human again... And he realizes he has to overpower the insect DNA with more human DNA. I'm not sure why he decided to go with Veronica rather than that douche he just melted the hand and foot off.
See, that's what I thought he was going to do.
Yeah. Why sacrifice the woman you love instead of becoming one with the woman you love?
Because he had gone insane. Yeah, I mean, right. And now all he can think about is being.
Yeah. Well, at that point, right? And he'd learned about her being pregnant and thought, well, that's my DNA in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So and that's the other factor too.
The last vestige of himself.
Yeah.
But we
that
don't
may
know
be pure
that.
DNA. Yeah. Right.
You don't know that. Did she get pregnant before or after?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sort of that whole thing. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. And she's got something growing inside. Like, how terrifying. He's got something growing inside of him, but which apparently he's perfectly comfortable with. Doesn't mean she should be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, she's freaking out left, right, and center. She wants it gone.
She totally wants it gone. And her panic through the whole situation was so well handled and so well done. Especially after that like final visit with Brundle before she comes down and says, we got to go do it now.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I see what's happening to this. And I do, if this baby's contaminated, I really need it gone like yesterday. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And there was the fly who dreamt he was a man.
Yeah. That great line. Great line.
Oh, and then there was my other question. Brundle fly. Was that something that existed prior to this film? The term Brundlefly?
No, it's just a combination of terms.
Just a combination, yeah. Okay. Because I was like, I've heard it used other times, and I'm like, Brundlefly.
No.
It became part of the popular and like sort of the colloquial lexicon of our generation.
Yeah.
Right, and that's, so you probably heard it before because people talk about Brundlefly, right?
Yeah.
And same with the be afraid, be very afraid line.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is a lot of people don't realize that this is the movie where that came from.
Yeah.
Right.
That's okay. Yeah, because it just became so. I just heard it so many times without the context of this film, like used in other ways.
I mean,
so
they sometimes change some classic literature lines, like that thing about the plasma pits and stuff. Yeah. It was. I had to figure that one out, and I guess it was a reference to some poem where they changed a word to the plasma thing. But
And Vincent Price saying the word flat screen in the original.
Yes, that was so cool.
I freaked out. I'm like, what the hell?
Such a futurist.
Really,
what did he invent? A flat screen? God damn it, Vincent.
And it only took 50 more years before we got to see them?
I know, right?
Yeah, you know what? You talk about how prophetic Bill Gates was. Vincent Price has got is way
He's kicked his ass.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I think it wasn't in the sequel. Doesn't he run the experiment? Carry on the experiments? I don't know. I can't remember. I might have to watch that again.
Yeah, I'll have to do that. Watch both sequels. Well, maybe one of the sequels.
Yeah, I've only seen one of them, I'm sure, which I think is the second one.
Return of the Fly, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, poor Helene. Like, just through her film, she's pretending to be insane for the sake of her son.
Yes.
It's better than a murderous mother
who's
insane than anything else.
Yeah, she's definitely doing it to protect it. And after she recounts that whole story of the transformation and him starting to lose control, initially he theorizes that he can recombine if they find the other fly, but they just, days go by and they just haven't been able to find it, and he kind of gives up.
He's afraid of losing complete control.
Yeah. And harming his family.
Yeah, because he'd already sort of started to become dangerous towards towards Helene at this point.
Yeah, right? And that's when he decides to destroy all of his equipment and erase all his boards and burn all his notes. He's like, I gotta get that. That is his last wish as a human mind. He's like, this cannot be shared with
humanity. Nobody can replicate my work.
Yeah.
In both movies it happens, and in both cases, it's kind of stupid because the technology does work. It's dangerous, but it's still useful technology in the right hands.
It is, right? But time and again, you've proved that the people with money will not use it for good use.
No. Well, we've seen lots of movies with the terrors of technology and the worst of what can come of it. Well, not so much
the technology itself. The terror comes from the idiots who have the money to get it.
Yeah,
sure,
or have the power to misuse it.
Well, and then that's just it, the misuse. Yeah. And his misuse of it results in him becoming a fly.
Yeah.
And that was the same with Jeff Goldblum's Brundle character. You know, he gets drunk thinking that about her boss, who was the old boyfriend. He's putting all this stuff together.
After he gets drunk and jealous
and does something stupid.
Yeah, don't get drunk and use your experiment.
You might become a Brundle fly.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. That's a bad idea. But with Helene at the end, like when they're at the press and she knows what he wants her to do, and she does do it because one of the arm comes out.
And she has to hit the button
again. And she has to put it back and hit the button again. Like, can
and
you
she
imagine?
Won't look. She just kind of just puts it in there without looking at the mess of his head.
Yeah, but she does it. Like, she finds that strength to do it because that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
And what she knew.
There's something about, like, and that was another thing about the 50s, now you see blood in color.
Yeah.
So when we first see that machine and whatever squished in there, we just see this blood dripping out from it. And even that is pretty horrific. I mean, the blood's really red.
Yeah, it's really
It's not
red.
Really realistic, but
it's 50s blood,
Technicolor blood.
Yeah, but it's still pretty startling.
I will admit I was a bit surprised to see it because I'm like
for a 50s movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they would shy away from we're still shying away from that at that point, but apparently not.
Yeah.
Well, it's late 50s. Yeah. You're starting to get into where they're...
I mean, that had to be pretty gory for the 50s.
Well, Peeping Tom happened 62 years later.
Yeah, that's right.
Going back to that episode, you guys did Peeping Tom?
Yes. Great episode.
Still one of my favorite watches for this show or for this podcast.
Yeah, that was a huge surprise. I mean, I'd heard how people revered that movie, but damn, I had no idea.
But now we know why.
Yeah, that's the great thing about, you know, 2 years later and the surprises we've had.
Yeah. Some stuff way ahead of its time. Just way ahead.
Yeah.
It's not much you can do.
Yeah.
It's a different... Both movies sort of have the different perspective.
Yeah. And in the end, it's still the girlfriend/wife that has to
complete
the suicide.
Yes.
Yeah. Because after the failed transformation of Brundlefly and he fuses into the pod, she grabs a shotgun for protection mostly, but doesn't want to shoot him. And he pulls the gun towards his head.
You have to end it.
Yeah.
Because it was bad enough before. Now this is absolutely no way to
live. And he had to be in absolute agony.
Yeah.
It's one of those tropes they kind of had, I think they borrowed from like the werewolf genre, whereas a silver bullet is fine, but usually it has to be fired by someone who loves you. Mm-hmm. And they took it and ran with that.
Yeah.
It's like to be destroyed by the one that you love. It's the only person you can trust to do it properly if you're in that much pain, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Like it's just so tragic.
It is. And I mean, we talked about the empathy you have for both of these characters. Yeah. They're the monsters, and they both do well, particularly in the Brundlefly, does some pretty horrific things, right? I mean, melting off Stathis's hand.
But he never kills anybody.
And then he breaks, and aside from breaking the other guy's arm.
Except the baboon.
Yeah.
That was an accident.
That was an unintended side effect of the experiment.
Yeah,
yes.
He's definitely getting colder and colder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more primal, right? So neither of them are monsters in the pure sense of the word yet, but they're getting there.
Yeah.
Right.
Apparently there's a scene, and I don't think it was ever shot for the remake, where he actually does kill and feed on a bag lady.
Ooh.
In an alley. Yeah. Which I can see why they never did it, because again, that darkens the character too much and you just don't have a lot of sympathy after that.
Yeah.
He's already lost a lot of sympathy at the point where he's trying to force people into the pod all the time,
and
he's become very sort of vicious and antagonistic.
But it goes from making you uncomfortable
to really outright hating him.
Exactly. Because that's the way I felt about it. Is I was really uncomfortable. It's like your racist aunt. You don't want to be around her, but you still kind of like her.
Force potting is not cool.
No.
Yeah.
Consent.
No. Consent.
Yeah.
There must always be consent before transportation.
Exactly. But it's always about, too, about having, you need to see how you see in her eyes, where she's like, I know the man I used to know. Yeah. And that's the trouble, is like it's disappearing. This man is disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And she can see it.
Quite literally can see it, see him disappearing. But yeah, I mean, you get more emotionally attached to Brundle than you do to Andre. Because Andre, you're right, is in it so little. And most of his time he's either got that towel over his head or...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you're experiencing him through Helene.
Yes.
You're not really experiencing him first person.
And you got to give kudos to David Hedison for taking on a part where you're going to be under makeup most of the time or under a towel or whatever. And it's going to be a very physical performance.
Yeah. Mm.
See, and you know what? As dated as it is, I loved the fly head and I loved the fly arm.
Mm-hmm.
I like them, like the texture of it, the hairy texture.
Oh yeah, no, it was a fun watch. Once you finally got the reveal, it was a lot of fun, and it's still fun, right?
Yeah.
Even with our modern special effects, sometimes they're not as effective as these older special effects.
I'm surprised Cronenberg didn't do the eye vision, because I really liked that. Yeah. I guess maybe it might come off a little cheesy, but I wouldn't have minded what Cronenberg's version of that would look like.
Oh yeah, his would have been mental.
It would have been very, great. Very interesting. Yeah.
We never really see that happen to Brundlefly until right at the end, when he finally sheds off the human form.
Yeah, the human exo bit, which is just
Yeah,
yeah. When she pulls off his jaw.
Oh. Ew!
Yeah.
If you could see her waving around right now. Yeah.
This gooey, gooey jaw.
Yeah, it was. If you haven't seen it recently, it's definitely worth a rewatch. And watch the original.
It's a juicy movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of goo. I think if they use lube for goo, they went through a lot of it.
Yeah, actually, it was vomit. I read what that was. That was egg and honey and, I don't know, vanilla or something. I don't know. It probably didn't even taste that bad.
That sounds like a meringue.
Yeah.
You cook those up in the oven, they puff up real nice. They're good.
Yeah.
But when they get like poured from a mouth onto somebody's hand, they look rather disgusting.
It looks pretty disgusting.
Yeah, that is pretty bad.
Yeah. And I love that bit. It was the first time that he does it in front of Gene Davis.
It was an accident.
And he's like, oh, that's disgusting. there's a few really well-timed moments of levity in there.
Yeah.
Like he forgot. He's like, oh, yeah, something new has happened. I forgot to tell you.
Oh, he's so pussy.
Yeah.
I have to do this now. Did I not mention that?
Yeah. And the bit where he's recording, the recording has changed for Veronica, he's talking to the kids.
The kids need to see this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I found it horrible. Like actually quite funny, because it was obviously horribly inappropriate for any child to see what was happening to him. He's like, yeah, I have to vomit on my food just like a fly, right?
But I don't know, the thing with kids, it's weird, they kind of love goo. Like they slime people at like the Nickelodeon's Choice Awards. Wasn't there a toy a long time ago where snot came out of the guy's nose and it was goo?
I don't know.
Like, kids like gross crap. I could see why they would like
I suppose, yeah. Yeah, I can see it. But it's still horribly inappropriate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you shouldn't show this to your children.
No.
I think the grossest part for me was when he tears off the finger and then he squeezes it. And it's just like a pussy zit. And I'm like, gross.
So bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's no grossness in the original. I mean, the grossest thing is that overly vivid blood. Everything else is just really, it's more in your head than it is.
Yeah, it's
visual.
More psychological trauma. And yeah, I did enjoy when like the inspector, after hearing all the story, and we catch up back up to the part where he's been crushed, and she's finished recounting the story, and he's like, fucking arrest her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is nuts.
Yeah. Well, not so much arrest as commit her.
Yeah.
So he's going to get the thing to get her committed forever. Yeah.
But Philippe happens to mention to Vincent Price's character
Francois,
that he saw the white-headed
fly. Oh, the
fly
they're looking for. I know where it is.
Yeah, by the bench, which we actually see it earlier by the bench because he's sitting there and he's just kind of staring off into space. And, and you hear
help
the
me. Help me.
Yeah, the very iconic help me. Which is still, it's, I was reading about this movie and apparently him and Vincent Price and Herbert Marshall could not keep a straight face during that whole scene. Like, it went through a lot of takes.
I can imagine, because it's
probably pretty ridiculous for them.
It is probably pretty ridiculous for them, but it is iconic. And I love the fact that there's 2 points in the remake where Brundlefly says, "Help me." Very nice little appropriate homages to the original film. Mm-hmm. And there was a song written by Brian Ferry called "Help Me" that was originally intended for the movie. They do play like a brief
In the bar.
In the bar, you hear it very briefly, but it was never released on the soundtrack.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a hard one to find.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, pretty rare. Although, in this day and age of accessibility of the internet and stuff might be a little less rare.
Yeah, exactly. You'll probably find it.
Yeah.
Somebody has it somewhere and somebody's uploaded it somewhere.
I haven't found YouTube. So I've found it on YouTube, but I haven't looked either.
Yeah. No, it is on a Roxy Music box set or something like that.
Right.
It was included in there somewhere, but we're not talking about music. We're talking about movies.
It ties in very nicely.
Exactly. It is available in at least one release.
And that's how the fly version ends as well. It's stuck in the web. It's about to get eaten by a spider. And believe it or not, but everybody goes to look because the kid said it was out there. Like, well, if they see this, if Shiraz sees this, then it exonerates her.
Yeah.
Maybe, I guess, it's manslaughter?
Suicide. Because at the end of the film, you find out how to cover up a murder. what you need is 2 men to say that it was suicide.
That's true, yeah. They see it, and Shiraz just kind of freaks out, picks up a big stone or
and
log
crushes
or something.
Both the spider and fly.
Yeah, it crushes everything. And that's when they concoct their lie for her, because now he's seen it. He can't unsee it. It's like, well, shit, that paperwork's going to get complicated.
And then Francois brings up a very good point. He's like, well, we now know what she said is true. She's killed a creature that was partially her husband. So if she's a murderer, you're a murderer because you killed the other half of her husband.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to help us cover this.
Yeah. He's now in the same boat.
But yeah, as a person who's terrified of spiders, that was the scariest part of both movies. Because I just a big spider freaks the hell out of me.
Oh, I can't wait to do our spider episode.
I know. It's going to be terrifying.
I might have to push that one up the schedule.
There's going to be squeamishness all over the place.
Yeah, you're going to have to be she's going to be texting you while she's watching all these movies, calling you names. You realize that, right?
Oh, yes, fine.
Oh, I won't be calling you names.
I'll
be like, I am sitting here crying, you bastard.
That's calling names. I told you.
And, how dare you?
But if it makes you feel better, someday we'll do snakes.
Snakes will bother me like they used to.
Aww.
Oh, I love snakes. So there we go. Okay, as long as we do snakes, I'm fine with spiders. All right.
And I'm cool with snakes.
Yeah, and thankfully there aren't a shit ton of moth movies, so.
No. No, although there's a really good, if you say this BBC show, Ginge the Geordie and the Geek, they have a great moth sketch that you will freaking love.
Because, I don't like moths.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, no, I realize as an adult that I have to stop letting things make me squeamish.
Well, I don't know. I don't think you have to stop. Like, I mean, as an adult, like, I theoretically know about spiders. I know theoretically they aren't going to hurt me. I know theoretically in my head. That does not help.
Unless you're a human fly.
Yes.
then they're a pretty big risk.
Yeah.
That poor spider.
Yeah, which they also do in a homage to in The Simpsons, where Bart fools the spider's like, help me, and just punches
sucker.
It in the face. Sucker.
Flies away, and then the spider's holding up its arms, arms. And waving at him like,
you darn kids.
That darn fly.
Damn you, Bart Simpson.
Oh, you want more syrup, honey?
There's one thing I still don't understand. When Bart went through the transporter, what happened to his head?
It'll turn up somewhere.
Help me! Help me! Sucker.
Sucker.
Yeah, well, that was The Fly. Final thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I don't know. I think both, if you think about both, it was sort of, mm-hmm. yeah, when you talk about the terror of losing your humanity and, like, disease and...
Oh, yeah, it's definitely, Cronenberg's all about that, and he spends a lot of time on the symptoms
yes.
of it all. Yeah. You know, what it's doing to his skin and the sensitivity of that. Like,
and mentally. Like,
mentally.
Because you actually... Mm-hmm.
It hurts for him to even type. He's got to wear gloves.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't want to shy away. Like, as much as you talk about Cronenberg and body horror, his body horror is really, it's rooted in a lot of stuff that can actually happen to a human body. That's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah, no, it's genius. And I think both movies are great products of their time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to see what I'm sorry, I'm just put this out there into the universe, but if I see what another remake would do now, 30 years later.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, it's been 30 years since this remake.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to even think about, but yeah.
And we're about due, because it was almost yeah. exactly 30 years after yeah. when the first remake occurred. So,
and I'm sure it's on somebody's wish list.
And there's still
now.
Some like experimentation on like trying to transmit stuff. Like they're trying to do it with atoms, like at the very basic level.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, we are doing that with technology.
Yeah, on a very small scale.
With the
very,
quantum very theory small. And all that yeah. stuff, because you but, can only do so much.
Yeah, I don't think we've transported large objects yet, but
that's,
atoms, that's in and of itself yeah. is quite spectacular.
Well, you think about the complexity of the human body. Like, you have atoms upon atoms upon atoms making, like, a cell, and then you have, like, a cell, and then all the different cells do different things. So you have a different types of cells all creating the cells, and then there's like a whole mm-hmm. bunch of water in all these cells. Like it's insane.
Well, and you think about something like transportation, especially on a moving sphere like our planet Earth, mm-hmm. it's not just transportation to somewhere else. You got to account for all those, that genetic code down to the what makes each atom, which mm-hmm. makes up the human body of whatever's going in. But you also got to account for where you're jumping to and where that point is in space and time on our Earth.
Well, that's what they always yeah. thought was that this was the major problem with time travel, is because you can hop somebody to the same space, but the Earth probably isn't there
yeah.
when you get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, I was watching this, and especially when I was watching the 1958 version of this movie, I'm like, wait a minute. Did Gene Roddenberry steal this concept from The Fly, the yeah. whole concept of transport?
And maybe. I mean, was The Fly the first time we even saw this?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably not. I'm pretty sure there's
lots of science fiction
yeah.
at that point. So.
There was a lot of it at that point. It was the golden age of science fiction and speculative fiction, for sure. But I was saying what a remake today would look like, I'm like, I wonder if you could kind of tie it into that Star Trek universe.
Right? Ooh.
Kind of fun.
That would be fun.
Anybody out there listening? Kind of fun.
Just one of the Star Trek movies. They're watching The Fly.
There's a new series that might be a good episode.
Yeah,
that'd be good.
Yeah, because I mean, it's essentially the exact same theory.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Theoretical. I guess it doesn't have to be a fly, but you can certainly steal from the same thing,
and yeah.
especially if it's set before the original series, where those transporters were a little dodgy.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you're like, you want to be transported, like, oh no.
Yeah, because it wouldn't work in the new Star Trek universe, because they were brand new technology in the new new Star Trek universe.
Well, yeah, well, they've already discovered how to do that thanks to Khan in the second one. Yeah. We can just translate from planet to planet. What the fuck do we need starships for?
Yeah, but then you have Scotty, who figures out how it is like to get from that to like a moving ship. It's like trying to hit a bullet with another bullet while riding a horse. Bareback or something like that, which I thought was funny. And then like he has that lovely line where he's like, oh, it never really occurred to me that space was a thing that was moving.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
Yeah,
there's some they completely different series of movies, but yeah, it goes back to what you were talking about too, right, where it's not just as simple mm-hmm. as transporting something across a room, but
yeah, you know, this kind of goes back to last week with The Creature, where I felt it was felt more in the horror camp, although it's very much called a sci-fi movie. This one, I think, is very entrenched in science fiction.
Yeah.
While still maintaining the horror.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, one of my favorite genres is the science fiction horror, because you get two of my favorite things, science fiction and horror, all in one great big gooey mess.
Oh, it's great. It's great, because, I mean, with sci-fi, there's just so much more horror you can add to it, and then just add the horror of, like, just mistakes. human mistakes and how this goes badly.
A lot of science fiction is about that. It incorporates that in how human error either creates great masterpieces of science or can completely undermine science. Mm-hmm. Right, so it fits very nicely, and that's why it always seems to work so well when it's well done.
And also with science fiction, like with horror, a lot of the times if it's just straight horror, you don't feel empathy for the monster. But what sci-fi always did was there's always something you're looking for within the monster. It's that scientific sort of logical thing where, like, it can't. Yeah, they just won't let it be completely one thing. It's not all black and white. It's just you have to analyze it.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. If our audience, our fellow invaders, have comments about The Fly, we've barely scratched the surface of it. These movies are robust and have big fan bases as well, and I'm sure you have your own comments and questions and suggestions. You can add your two cents on our social media. We're on Facebook as Invasion of the Remake, Twitter at Invasion Remake, and invasionremake@gmail.com. And I don't know if it'll be up and running by then, but we may have an Instagram and Tumblr down the road.
Woohoo! We'll just put goo in it.
We're toying with that. So look for that in the near future as well. You can also share out this episode as well as all our other 101 episodes as of now.
Well, technically 104 if you count zero and the two Christmas specials.
That's right. That's right. It'd be 104. So all 104 episodes, you can let people know where to find us. We are on Libsyn, iTunes, Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. I'll say both because I don't know what the hell that is. They keep rebranding and it just confuses me. Mm. TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Stitcher, Google Play Music. I think we're on Spreaker now. And of course, YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Freaking YouTube.
Freaking YouTube. T-shirts coming soon.
Yes.
Maybe.
Or maybe not, because you don't want to get in trouble for copyright infringement with using the YouTube logo.
Oh, no. You sneeze and you get some sort of copyright notice on YouTube.
YouTube. Yeah. Why is it my tube? It's not my tube, apparently.
No.
Said you in it, but apparently you didn't mean that.
It's not me. It's them.
They lied.
It's them tube.
Yeah, you should have called it us tube and then just left it at that YouTube.
Yeah. And another way you can help out the show is leave us a 5-star rating and a review over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Certainly helps other people find the show, and just, you know, leave us a comment there as well. It helps everybody out. And, you know, if you don't have 5 stars to give, I mean, just give us an honest rating. We'll take 4. Mm-hmm. I'm not greedy. I'll take 4.
4 is good. I like 4.
4 is above average.
Exactly. Yeah,
I'll take above average.
We're very Canadian. We don't want to get too into ourselves. Like, you know, be fair. Be fair.
Yeah. But don't be mean either.
Yeah. And, you know, as 2 years later, big thanks to all our invaders who've been listening since day one, and we've picked up along the way. We had a huge boom last month. We've actually almost tripled our numbers just within a span of a month. That was fantastic to see, especially around our anniversary. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to just keep seeing that moving forward. Mm-hmm. So like us on our social media, find us there, and spread the word. You see us tweet something out or post it on our Facebook or any other social medias that you might follow us on. Share it out on your feeds as well. It'll help us out a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Telepod us out someplace.
Yes. Yeah. Telepod us out and, you know, just make sure the pod is clean before you go.
Yes. Oh my God, there's no flies in it.
That's right.
Or any other foreign objects you don't want to be merged with.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know, I haven't, because we always record ahead of time, I don't know if anybody caught our hint in the creature episode of what this episode was going to be. So I dropped it near the end of the episode last week. So yeah. I'm very interested to see if anybody catches it when the creature episode finally goes up.
Nice.
Yeah, it'll be fun to see.
They're savvy. Yeah. They're pretty savvy.
And we hope that our conversations are open to conversation with you and your friends. Right? Mm. I mean, because that's what this is. This is kind of born out of conversations that we would normally have anyhow.
Yes,
and
right.
We decided we'd share them with you. Right. So if hopefully you guys are having these conversations and you're telling your friends sort of, hey, if you like this kind of conversation.
That's right.
Check out Invasion of the Remake.
Our cinema conversation circle has gotten a lot bigger, and we want you to be a part of it. So join in the conversation on all those media platforms.
And for sure. And I mean, some of these movies, you may not have seen them. Find them. Watch them. They're pretty interesting, a lot of them.
We always encourage, I mean, you can see the episode when it drops. If you want to take a day to watch the movie before the podcast, absolutely do it, because then you feel like you're really part of the conversation.
Yeah. And you can pick up on stuff we may have missed or may not have gotten.
Oh, trust me. Yeah. Even in an hour and a half to 2 hours, it's hard to scratch everything, especially when you're talking about multiple movies. So we're going to miss a lot, and that's okay, because it sparks much more conversation in those other platforms. And we might read some of those comments on the air as well. So, you know, but that won't happen if you don't get involved.
Exactly. We love movies, and we want to love movies with you.
That's right.
That sounds dirty, but I didn't mean it that way.
Oh, Trish.
If you want a date with Trish, you can call
403, bad idea.
I'm guessing she didn't want me to give out her phone number.
No, a date with me just might be really awkward, so bad idea. Sam is just shaking his head.
Yeah, just because I don't know what to say. Like, I want to weigh in on this so bad, but to me it just seems like a lose-lose situation, so I'm just going to hush.
There we go. It's all good.
All right, well, I'm going to transport myself out of here. I've been Jason, until I'm Brundle Jason. No, I don't want to be Brundle Jason. I might be Bishop Fly.
Ooh.
I like that.
Bishop Fly. I've been Bishop Fly.
I'm always Sam, and I'm never Fly.
Trish, I've never been a fly girl. But yeah, if I was to choose my other animal, I want to be Wolf Trish. I don't want to be Fly Trish.
And we are out of here.
I'm an insect who dreamt he was a man and loved it. But now the dream is over and the insect is awake.